Hey everybody, welcome back to our podcast. This is Murder With My Husband. I'm Peyton Moreland.
And I'm Garrett Moreland.
And he's the husband.
And I'm the husband.
Thank you so much for listening to our show. If you are watching on YouTube, please subscribe. Please turn on notifications. And if you are just listening in on podcasts, hi. If you are able to, please leave a review. It helps us out so much. And if not, we are just happy to have you here listening to us, being a part of this family. So thank you, thank you, thank you so much for being here.
Real quick, before we hop into this, for anyone who is watching on YouTube, for our Patreon, we're actually going to start uploading our YouTube videos a day earlier on Patreon. Than we are on YouTube. And then also all of our Patreon exclusive episodes, we're going to start doing YouTube videos with those and not just podcast episodes.
Yeah, we were getting a couple of comments from our YouTube watchers who are also wanting to help support the show through Patreon, but we weren't having that like available for them. So we are going to start doing that now, I think starting this month.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So for this month, yep. Okay, Garrett, do you have your 10 seconds for this episode?
Well, I guess Peyton and I went boating last weekend. Last week-ish.
Yeah.
That was really fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. We went with Garrett's family, and it's always fun to be with them. And yeah, it was really fun.
It was really fun.
It was really fun, you guys.
It was really, really fun. In case no one understood, it was really fun.
Gosh, you guys, you think we would be getting better at this, but you know, sometimes we aren't.
This is why we have to hop into the story. Yeah. Could you imagine us rambling for 35 minutes?
Speaking of which, we do need to hop in because I do think it's going to be a long episode today. So let's get right into it.
Let's do it.
This case is our most suggested case by far. We are listening to you guys. We are giving you what you want. We have over 3,000 case submissions on our Google form, but this is the highest requested one.
Wow. Okay.
That being said, it's also a more well-known case, especially in Canada, where it's from. We will not be providing the smallest details in our episode covering this story because there is a lot known about this story. You can dive into a rabbit hole of specifics with this case, but we will be giving you all of the need-to-knows today. So feel free to add more details in the comment sections that we have chosen to leave out. Okay, I do just need to give a warning before we jump into the case. This case involves sexual assault, it involves minors, and it also involves murder, and this can be triggering for some people, so listener discretion is advised. Our case sources are a documentary called Serial Killer Global, and then also a YouTuber named Stephanie Harlow did a 3-part series, deep dive, dissected everything in her serial killer series. So we will be linking that in the case description, but a lot of our information is going to be coming from her. So shouts out to her. If you're wanting like a very in-depth dive into this case, that is a really great option. On Saturday, June 29th, 1991, in the town of St. Catharines near Ontario, Canada, a group of fishermen are spending their day on Lake Gibson. They notice several concrete blocks sticking out of the water on one end of the lake. They investigate further, only to make a horrifying discovery. There are what appears to be pieces of human sticking out between the cracks in the blocks, like the blocks are pinning them down into the water. Niagara Regional Police are called in and conduct a thorough search of the water and find a total of 8 concrete blocks. Each block contains body parts of what they believe to be a young female body. They are confident that the female body belongs to that of a missing girl in the nearby town of Burlington by the name of Leslie Mahaffey. Leslie had been missing for 2 weeks and was 14 years old. A little less than a year later, on April 16, 1992, 15-year-old Kristen French goes missing from her hometown of St. Catharines. A couple weeks later, on April 30th, 1992, a man searching for scrap metal on the side of the road in Burlington finds Kristen's body in a ditch. She had been sexually assaulted, beaten, and strangled to death. Police eventually suspect that there is a connection between the two murders, both in the same areas, both within a year. They believe this isn't the first time this killer has killed either. They have an experienced serial killer on their hands.
Okay. Hopping right into it.
Mm-hmm. So, but let's actually back up 5 years, give you a little context. In 1987, we're still in Canada. 17-year-old Carla Homolka is a high school student who works part-time in a pet store. She was the oldest of 3 girls who grew up in St. Catharines. And as a child, she spent a lot of time in the hospital due to asthma issues. Despite the illness, Carla was a perfectionist from the time she was young. She was described as a prodigy because she had to be the best at everything she did.
Okay.
She had perfect grades, and friends in elementary school described her as bossy and everything had to be her way. We're talking like she's playing with Barbies. The story has to be her way. She got to pick which boy Barbie she wanted, what outfit she wanted, everything. She was pretty. She had blonde hair. Think of like a JonBenet Ramsey looking child. By middle school, Carla was interested in the Nancy Drew books and wanted to be a detective when she grew up. And I do have to say Nancy Drew was my favorite books growing up.
Okay. Sorry, JonBenet Ramsey?
Yes. She is the pageant girl who was killed. She's
got
little.
It.
She's blonde. She's beautiful.
Keep going. Got it. Okay.
So as Carla gets older, the more interested she got in death. She talked about it with people. She loved Ouija boards. She was starting to wear a lot of black. She was going through a phase, which I'm all for, but she was also really struggling with admitting that she was ever wrong and could be mean. Despite dressing and acting different than most girls, Carla was really popular in high school and honestly almost started like a trend of girls who began to dress and act like her too. So at Carla's school, the really popular girls all wore black. They were all kind of like into this dark side or whatever. And she started this trend.
So she's 14, right?
Yes. Now, I don't want people to think that like goth and death is wrong or scary because liking true crime, people thought I was weird when I talked about it, you know, like quote unquote dark things. I don't think curiosity is wrong. Be who you are. But Carla was struggling with some personality issues and had created quite a cult following of mean girls, according to most sources. But Carla loved animals and, like I said, was working at a pet store during high school. So on October 17th, 1987, in the town of Scarborough, Carla is attending a pet food convention. She's still in high school.
Uh-huh.
And on this night, her and her coworker are having a late night snack in the hotel lobby cafe. It was during this snack that a young, blonde, attractive man walked into the cafe and completely knocked Carla off her feet. 23-year-old Paul Bernardo is going to school to be an accountant and was set to graduate from the University of Toronto. He was the youngest of three children and from the time he was young had his looks going for him. Although he had struggled speaking as a child, which led to some bullying at an early age, he excelled the older he got. By the time he was 10, he had made friends with the neighborhood kids and teachers at school loved him. He was a top Boy Scout and a straight-A student. But Paul had struggles with a verbally abusive mom and dad who fought a lot. And at age 15, his girlfriend, who he thought he would like end up marrying, broke up with him. So at age 16, when he found out that his dad wasn't actually his biological dad, it devastated him. Paul's mother had had an affair and Paul was the product of that couple. Paul was mad at his mother, but also mad at his dad, who now he knows is not actually his dad, because his dad had begun to molest Paul's 9-year-old sister. And it was exact thing that caused Paul's mother to gain a lot of weight and give up as a mother and wife.
Okay.
So it's pretty easy to say that Paul's growing up life was kind of a struggle. His household was not a very peaceful, calm household.
So when he walks into the hotel, he's 23, she's what, 16, 17?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Paul graduated high school and joined a multi-level marketing company and used the recruiting tools that they taught him to pick up women at bars.
Really?
Yeah. So,
basically it was like a sales game to him.
Yes. Yes. He was like, girls are a game. After his high school sweetheart had broke his heart, everything in his life had kind of gone downhill. He was really struggling. And now we're at the time of our story where he had joined college and just walked into the hotel. So it's October 17th, 1987. Carla sees Paul Bernardo walk into the hotel where she was eating. And according to multiple sources, it was love or lust at first sight between Paul and Carla. Paul was tall, blonde, and good looking. Carla was young, blonde as well, and really pretty. Paul was confident and forward, immediately hitting on 17-year-old Carla. And within hours of meeting, Carla Homolka and 23-year-old Paul Bernardo have made their way up to Carla's hotel room together. And then they ... So Carla believed that Paul was the man of her dreams. Carla and Paul's immediate attraction was intense and strong. They went full force on the relationship.
Okay.
They were completely obsessed and entranced in each other. In high school, Carla had actually dated several boys, but none like Paul. He was older. He was more mature. She bragged to all of her friends at school about her new hot old boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
But her hot new boyfriend had a secret. Paul Bernardo had begun peeking in neighbors' windows looking for changing women at the age of 16.
Oh, man. Here we go.
Yeah. He had soon realized that his sexual preference didn't really involve consenting partners or women his age. He was obsessed with virgins. But a young Paul knew this was wrong, and so he hid it. He was charming and well-liked and dated many women in college, but all of those relationships ended for one reason. Their sexual relationship became abusive. He would become fixated on being violent towards his girlfriends during sex. He lived a double life, perfect, kind, good-looking, successful man on the outside, but this controlling, violent, angry man in his dating life.
So how would he know if someone was a virgin? Would he just ask them, or was it that he just liked younger girls?
So both. He would ask, okay, but I don't think that that's a very sure way of knowing. And so the younger the girl he got, the more secure he was in the fact that she probably was a virgin.
Okay. So did he always go for younger girls, or did he also go for older ones that might have been virgins?
No, he dated women his age.
Okay.
But no, I mean, Carla's obviously 17. She's still in high school. He's in college. He's 23. Yeah, he's going for younger girls.
Okay.
So one of his last girlfriends before Carla that he had dated in college threatened to go to the police after a sexual encounter they had had. And it was during this time that Paul realized his girlfriends would not be enough. They would not accept him for who he is and what he wanted. So he began attacking strangers during his time at college.
What?
He would pull women off the street at night after they got off the bus or were walking back to the dorm and attack them behind bushes or wherever he could. These attacks began as just touching, but after 13 months of Paul doing this to women during college, he had escalated to full-on rape and more. These attacks were long, 30 minutes to an hour. It's not like he just quickly pulled them off, did his business, and left. He spent time with them.
So would he rape them?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Eventually, he started raping them, beating them.
But it's, okay.
His attacks gained, obviously, media attention, and he was dubbed the Scarborough Rapist. Hey everyone, I know that I have seen and heard of CBD everywhere, the mall, online, and if there was ever a time to get started with CBD, it's now. CBD is one of many cannabinoids found in hemp.
I really have seen it everywhere.
It's everywhere.
I know, it's crazy. So CBD has been proven by scientists that if used regularly, it can significantly help with daily stress.
And among other things, people also use CBD for a sense of calm and focus, as well as to maintain a healthy sleep cycle. And I don't know about you, but my sleep schedule is vital for me to have a productive day, both mentally and physically. Like, seriously, if I don't get my sleep, cannot function.
It is very, very true. My wife sleeps a lot. So I'm sure most of you might not know, but Charlotte's Web is literally the CBD industry pioneer that kicked off this whole CBD craze. Charlotte's Web extracts are tested 20 plus times from seed to final product.
And unlike many companies, they have their own proprietary hemp genetics, so the end products are consistent, meaning you know what to expect bottle to bottle. And as a certified B Corp, Charlotte's Web is a mission-driven company, which just means that they've promised to help the planet and humanity and all that stuff we look for in a company.
That's what I'm talking about. So go to charlottesweb.com to get started with the OG CBD brand who kicked off this whole CBD craze, and use code HUSBAND at checkout to save 15% on your order. This code works on all CBD products besides bulk bundles.
Once again, that was charlottesweb.com, and use code HUSBAND at checkout to save 15% off your order. That's huge.
Before we end this, we actually babysat a dog a couple weeks ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he used these like CBD chewies?
Yes.
Chews?
You guys, if Jepson, anyways, our dog, yes, uses CBD, you need to be using CBD.
That's actually, no, then I'm not going to lie. The dog was calmer.
It helped.
Yep. All right, let's go ahead and get back to the story.
Women were scared. It was a college town. It was a nightmare. And now there was this person going around, the Scarborough rapist, who was pulling girls off the street at night and attacking
them. Did he wear a mask or anything?
No. So the police took statements, but Paul had never shown his full face. You're always right there on my notes.
I know, right?
He was only described as young and good looking, but they were like, they never fully saw his face. It was dark.
Well, some trauma and all that, right?
Exactly. So they had taken DNA from over 100 suspects in search for the Scarborough rapist, but obviously none matched. A profiler was called in to help the case, and after analyzing police reports, he concluded that the total number of reported attacks at this point was up to 11.
Wow.
He profiled that the Scarborough rapist was anger-motivated and sadistic in nature, which made him extra dangerous. The women reported that during the attacks, he made them refer to themselves using degrading names like slut or whore. He hated women. Towards the end of the attacks, the women began being beaten. Police began to worry that he would soon escalate to murder. Police profiled the Scarborough rapist, who we know is Paul, as a high-functioning, sadistic psychopath who lives in the Scarborough area with family members. He would be in his early 20s and has a violent relationship with women in his life.
The profile was pretty correct.
It was pretty correct. When Carla met Paul, only 3 rapes had been linked to the Scarborough rapist so far. In fact, he wasn't even nicknamed that yet. So after Paul and Carla began dating, Paul continued to escalate and attack random women on the streets at night.
While they were dating.
Even though he was dating Carla. Because of this outlet, Paul was a great boyfriend to Carla. He bought her gifts and flowers. He was considerate and loving towards her. And their relationship was something fierce, intensifying physically and emotionally. And Paul hadn't completely hidden his violent sexual desires from Carla, but she accepted it. She thought it was cool. He's older, and being confident and cool herself, she was down. Remember, Carla is not a submissive. She's very confident. Yeah. She's very dominant. For Christmas, Paul gave Carla a teddy bear, and Carla gave Paul a coupon that said, when presented to Carla, she will perform sick and twisted sexual acts on Paul.
Okay.
So she was all in on this sexual relationship with Paul. Paul and Carla loved to video record their whole relationship, also including what they did in the bedroom. The first year and a half they were dating, and keep in mind, he's the Scarborough rapist through all of this.
I can't believe that he can hide himself that well. You know what I'm saying? Like, he goes and assaults and rapes girls, and then has a girlfriend on the side, and everything seems completely normal.
I mean, she knows that he has some dark desires with her in the bedroom. She knows. At this point, I don't think she knows he's the Scarborough rapist.
Got it. Okay.
But she definitely is going along with, and together she fully accepts him. So she's also bringing out this side of him, and he's bringing out this side of her. They're in this together.
Well,
yes, just their sexual relationship. So the first year and a half they're dating, Paul drove to see Carla in St. Catharines several times a week because remember, he lives in Scarborough and she lives in St. Catharines. And this is about an 80-mile trip. Acting as the Scarborough rapist at home and then as Carla's boyfriend at St. Catharines, Carla's family loved Paul. They thought that he was great for her. And I do have to mention here that he was an accountant, right? Like, he was graduating as an accountant or whatever. But he was also like a rapper. Like a rapper on the side. And he has like songs and stuff. And he's a rapper on the side. And her family loved this.
It would be really hard to identify him.
Yes, because he's really young.
He's an accountant. Yeah, he has a girlfriend.
He has blonde hair. He looks like a young boy. Like, he even has songs about that. Like, in his rapping, he's like, I know I look like a schoolboy, but I could beat you up. Like, he just looks like a Ken doll, like a Barbie and Ken doll. That's what he looks like. And Carla begins to notice that Paul wasn't necessarily crossing the finish line with her in the bedroom anymore. He seemed bored and distant. No matter how much she complied to his desires, it began to not be enough. This is also when she noticed Paul watching her younger sister.
Oh.
And Carla knew of Paul's sexual deviancy, and he was open about his obsession with virgins. So she was fully aware of this. Carla was not what Paul desired, and she knew that. So in the spring of 1989, Carla graduated from high school. And by September of that year, Carla had begun to tell people in her life that Paul was beginning to verbally abuse her. He was controlling and called her demeaning names and demanded that Carla refer to herself as those as well, like he was doing with his victims. He was becoming abusive, but Carla wrote him asking for it. She wrote him letters saying, "I want you to abuse me. I want you to talk down to me."
Okay.
She was usually the dominant, and she enjoyed being the submissive in this relationship. It was like Paul, a dominant, gave Carla, another dominant, the adventure of something new. So don't think that like Carla's a submissive in this. She's just putting on an act. But by December, on a trip to Niagara Falls, Paul asked Carla to marry him and she said yes. They were they were to get married in spring of 1991. And on May 29th, 1990, police actually released a sketch and a profile of the Scarborough rapist because one of the women had actually got a really good look at him. So they released the sketch to the public based on the victim's descriptions. And when the sketch is released, friends of Paul Bernardo call police and note the similarities.
Oh, no way. So multiple. It was pretty accurate then.
It was very accurate. We will be putting a side-by-side on our social media, and also there will be one up on YouTube. By November of 1990, police bring Paul in for questioning. And they request a DNA sample. They're like, "Too many people have said you look like this sketch, which you do. So we're going to bring you in. We're going to question you about what you were doing on the nights.
Oh, man.
And we're going to take a DNA sample."
Okay.
Paul plays it cool. He's confident. He's chill. He's a salesman. He says, "Sure, take my DNA." The DNA sample was sent to the lab and put in line behind hundreds of other samples that police had collected.
Of course.
It's the 90s. DNA is still new. It's not fast nor efficient. It's around this time that Paul Bernardo decides to move from Scarborough to St. Catharines to live with Carla and her family at Carla's parents' house. And he does this because I think he's feeling the pressure of the police cracking down on him in Scarborough. So he's like, "I got to get out of here." And with this comes the end of the attacks in Scarborough and the start of the attacks in St. Catharines. He didn't stop attacking. He just moved cities.
I was going to ask that. So I assume, I would hope at this point they put two and two together.
You would hope.
Okay.
But no. It's rumored that at this point, Carla is fully aware that Paul is the Scarborough rapist. So she's fully aware that he's doing this now. And she's accepting it. Bonnie and Clyde type crap is what we're dealing with.
Oh, she's accepting it.
She's accepting it. She's encouraging it. And they have even backtracked dates to try and find an alibi for Paul and all the attacks. So not only is she like, he's the Scarborough rapist, once police were kind of catching on to him, she was like, "We got to go back. We got to create an alibi." She was helping him figure out how to get out of this.
Why?
I know your mind is blown right now.
I just don't understand why. Is it because she, we'll just keep going.
We'll keep going. Okay. So, but Carla's family doesn't suspect Paul. I mean, they love him. He's going to be their future son-in-law. And at this point in their relationship, Carla is aware of Paul's sexual fantasies and needs. Just like his previous girlfriends, their sexual relationship had turned violent in nature. But unlike his previous girlfriends, Carla did what he wanted and encouraged it. She was obsessed with him. Paul had found someone who would do anything he needed. And despite this relationship, there was one thing Paul wanted that Carla couldn't give him, and that was virginity. Carla was aware of this, and together they had been experimenting trying to roofie her friends at like bars when they would go out and hang out.
Together.
They were trying to get someone for Paul to bring home and rape at the house with Carla.
What?
And she was the one making the concoction to roofie them too. She was using the supplies she got because she worked at a pet, like a veterinarian clinic. Uh-huh. And she was using the drugs that they use on the animals to try to use them on
people.
That
is so twisted.
So twisted. But at his core, Paul was a predator on young girls. So Carla's friends weren't doing. And he was fantasizing about violently taking someone's virginity, but it couldn't be Carla. After discussing this with Carla, he offered the unthinkable. He wanted Carla's 15-year-old sister, Tammy, who lived in the bedroom next door.
Okay.
Tammy loved Paul. He had kind of been abusing the big brother relationship with her for some time. I mean, she's young. This is her sister's boyfriend. He had been fantasizing about her, complimenting her, I would say grooming her. Paul and Carla had even drugged her with Valium once so that Paul could sneak into Carla's little sister's room and masturbate next to her while Carla recorded it with a camera.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. But now Paul wanted her completely, and desperately wanting to please her fiance, Carla agrees to drug her little sister Tammy so that Paul can have sex with her. Now, I know this is hard to understand.
Paul is one thing, and then the sister is just a whole nother.
Carla being okay with sister. This, it's, it, I know this is really hard like to
Paul's,
understand.
Paul's already messed up. I mean, he's already, he's,
yes.
he's raping people.
Yeah, he's been doing this.
But then.
But Carla yeah. has this in her too. It's almost like they are Bonnie and Clyde. Like yeah. Carla has met her match with Paul, and they, their love is intoxicating.
But do you think it's kind of like the one story you told me along a while ago, or episode we had a while ago, where he started to like his personality started to rub off on her?
Hers. I was going to discuss this a little more at the end, but yes, do I think that Paul would be Paul without Carla, and Carla would be Carla without Paul?
Yeah, yeah, that's my question.
No.
Okay.
I think they both would have gone down a path, certainly, but this soon, I think they are bringing it out in each other. I think they've found the other side of them, the other dark, twisted side of them that like said it's okay to be this. And so they've risen it to the top. You know what I mean? And it also is hard to understand if emotional manipulation and brainwashing is like a case here. I know we see that sometimes with men kind of using the submissive and taking advantage of it. But Carla is showing signs of evil without Paul. Mm-hmm. Like having saying, okay, here, take my sister is a whole nother level.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. All right, we're going to jump into an ad break real quick.
When it comes to true crime podcasts, Generation Y is a pioneer. If you're obsessed with crime mysteries and unsolved murder cases, this show has it all. Hosts Aaron and Justin cover cases from all angles. They break down theories, dive deep into forensic evidence, and discuss their opinions on the most perplexing cases.
In one recent episode, you'll hear the story of Brandon Embry, who experienced a violent death in his own apartment, followed by some outrageous claims as to the cause.
The medical examiner declared his cause of death as pneumonia, while detectives alleged it was drug-induced self-harm. Why were their stories so inconsistent, and what really happened to Brandon?
Or you can listen to another recent episode that covers the murder of 14-year-old Jody Jones. After her boyfriend discovered her body, he was named the only suspect in her murder and sentenced to 20 years without any forensic evidence.
That is literally the worst. Did the trial rush a conviction to find peace for Jody's family, or was he really the killer?
Listen to Wondery's The Generation Y podcast on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus and the Wondery app.
Wondery, fill the story. So Carla tells Paul that Tammy will be his Christmas present from her. So she's in on the game. She's like, yes, you can have her and it'll be my Christmas present to you. It's not even just like, oh, he really wants to
do
this.
Yeah, I can't.
It's evil.
Yeah.
So warning, I am going to be telling you the PG-13 version of these events, but they are still disturbing. So if you want to fast forward, feel free.
I will be right back.
On December 23rd, 1990, after Carla's family had gone to bed, it's basically Christmas Eve, Carla and Paul ask Tammy to stay up and hang out with them. They give her some cocktails laced with sleeping pills that were purchased by Carla. Carla uses a rag soaked in animal tranquilizers from the clinic she worked at to keep Tammy sedated. Carla then holds the rag over Tammy's mouth while Paul sexually assaults her. And after he's done, he suggests that Carla do it too. So Carla sexual assaults her own sister.
Oh my gosh.
Even worse, they videotape the whole thing so that they can go back and relive it together. Both of the rapes are on camera. It's after this that Tammy begins throwing up and choking. Carla's 15-year-old sister. Paul and Carla clean up the puke, hide the camera, and call 911. When the ambulance arrives, they tell paramedics that they had tried to revive her after she passed out from drinking with them. Tammy is taken to the hospital and sadly and devastatingly is pronounced dead.
What? She died?
They killed her. This innocent child was killed by her own sister and brother-in-law from overdosing on the drugs, the animal tranquilizers, the alcohol, and then she choked on her own vomit.
Okay. Were they not suspicious that there were pills and drugs and other stuff found besides alcohol?
So they had said that they were
doing pills and drinking that night.
Not the pills. They just said they were drinking. And she also had a chemical burn because you can't hold chemicals like that up to your skin. She had a chemical burn on her face, and Carly was like, no, that's just a rug burn from when we were like dragging her to try to resuscitate her. And police are like, okay, unsuspecting of innocent acting Carla and Paul, they're not, that you would never think that they did this. They determined that Tammy died of natural causes and no further investigation is taken.
Okay.
Tammy's death is like pronounced a tragic accident.
Oh, it's horrible.
So this was a lot to take in. Like, this is a really huge piece of this case. And I remember the first time I heard this case, I couldn't, because I have a sister. So Carla was frustrated at this point that Carla's parents struggled so bad after Tammy's murder. Can you even fathom what I just said?
Yeah.
She killed her own sister.
She was mad that her parents cared that her sister was dead.
Yeah, she was like, can't you guys just move on?
Mm-hmm.
And Paul felt like Carla owed him another virgin since Tammy had died, and that wasn't according to plan and had gone so wrong. So he's like, so you owe me another one. That one didn't work.
Holy crap.
Carla then decided to try to help this. She decided to role play as Tammy, her little sister, even wearing her old clothes in hopes of making Paul feel better. And they put this whole thing on video, and it is truly disturbing and disgusting. I've obviously not watched it. These videos have not been released to the public, but I have read transcripts, and it's really bad.
Like, this case is so messed up.
It is. And it's pretty clear that neither Carla nor Paul feel bad about what they did to Tammy. During this time, Carla and Paul assaulted a couple more girls, and Paul had even cheated on Carla with another woman that was more consensual, not an assault. And this hurt Carla's feelings. Like, Carla felt like she was losing this grasp. She even wrote him and was like, we used to be so amazing. We used to be this team, and now we're slipping. Yeah. So Carla decides that in order for her to be the only girl for Paul, she would need to do exactly what only she could do. A month later, Paul and Carla move out of her family's home in St. Catherine and into a house in Port Dalhousie, a town near St. Catherine. On June 15th, 1991, 2 weeks before their wedding, Paul wakes Carla up in the middle of the night with a present. A young girl, 14-year-old Leslie Mahaffey, the first victim at the beginning of our story.
Okay.
He had abducted her from her backyard, luring her to his car with a cigarette. Together, Paul and Carla repeat what they had done to Tammy, recording the whole thing on camera. Less than 24 hours after she was kidnapped, Paul and Carla strangle Leslie and put pieces of her body in concrete blocks and dump them into the lake.
I can't believe the first part of them sexually assaulting her. And then I can't believe they're just killing her afterwards.
It's like a true Bonnie and Clyde. Like, we are full on couple serial killers, which is weird.
But it's like
it's a strange phenomenon.
It's like a twisted version of Bonnie and Clyde.
The same day the first victim, Leslie's body, was discovered on Lake Gibson, where we started out this story, just 16 miles away in the town of Niagara, Paul and Carla get married. So the same day that victim is found, they're off in another town getting married. It's a big, beautiful wedding, complete with church bells and a carriage. There's footage of this. You can see it. We will have it on the YouTube. Now, 21-year-old Carla Homolka and 26-year-old Paul Bernardo exchange wedding vows in front of more than 100 family and friends together as serial killers while one of their victims is being discovered a couple miles away.
Yeah.
As police are investigating the murder of Leslie, the attacks from St. Catherine aren't included in the investigation, so they still haven't put two and two together. They are not connecting the dots. And Carla is acting as dutiful wife. She does her part of enticing young girls to the home so her and Paul can continue their game attacking these young girls together. They don't kill the girls they bring over this time. They just videotape it. They drug them. And once the girls wake up, they have no memory of it due to the drugs. Together, Paul and Carla are an evil team. On April 16th, 1992, Paul and Carla spot Kristen French walking home from school. She's our second victim that we talked about. Kristen loved her dog, Sasha, and could light up a room with her pure soul. Carla asks Kristen to come over to the car. They needed directions. And who is Kristen to not trust a young, innocent-looking couple in the middle of the day? It's so cruel. Together, the couple kidnaps Kristen and drives her to their home. And Kristen is reported missing. Witnesses come forward to police and tell them that they saw Kristen talking to two people right before she was taken, and that the three of them drove away in a beige Camaro. Two suspects, a beige Camaro. This was more than police had to go on this whole time. But the problem is, the eyewitness account was wrong. Paul does not drive a beige Camaro. We know that Kristen's body is found on April 30th, 1992 in a ditch in Burlington. In January 1993, Carla is admitted into the emergency room with a severe beating, two black eyes, and broken ribs at the hands of her husband, Paul. Their relationship is spiraling. She decides to move out. And it's around the same time the DNA collected more than 2 years earlier is finally tested, and Paul Bernardo is identified as the Scarborough rapist.
2 years. Okay.
It sat there for 2 years. He now lives in Port Dalhousie, where Leslie and Kristen had been murdered. Police had brought Paul in and questioned him years earlier and let him go. And now he's gone on to attack several more young girls and now murder three.
So I assume, hope at this point, they put two and two together now?
Yes, police have made the connection now. The Scarborough rapist is the St. Catharines rapist who is the murderer of Leslie and Kristen. This is huge.
Okay.
Police now reach out to Carla to see where she stands and confront her with the evidence. So instead of just going and immediately arresting Paul, they're like, we think there's another suspect, so we're going to reach out to his wife. Carla thought the police interview was just going to be about the domestic assault that had landed her in the hospital. Police didn't accuse her. They just told her what they have. Hey, your husband's the Scarborough rapist. This is what we have on him. It was during this time that Paul was put under surveillance. His phone was tapped and Carla is out free. The police let her go. She doesn't admit anything. And she is now separated from him and she's clubbing and she's moving on with new men. Paul, on the other hand, was spiraling. He was missing Carla, and Carla didn't seem to be hurting or recovering from an abusive relationship, which is what she's telling people.
Uh-huh.
And also, Paul is feeling the pressure of the police. Like, Carla's been interviewed. But the pressure of police closing in made Carla confess everything to her family one day. She's worried. She's like, I think that they're in on us. They're making that connection. And so she confesses to her family, but she gives her version of events confession.
Okay.
So Carla's family tells her to get an attorney and tell him everything. Her version, once again. She agrees to testify against her husband, Paul, in exchange for a reduced sentence. In her full confession, Carla admits that Paul is the Scarborough rapist and puts complete blame on Paul for her sister's murder, Leslie's murder, and Kristen's murder. She says that she was forced against her will to participate in everything, and that also they had videotaped it and that those videos are in the house if they want to go try to find them. She was an abused wife who was brainwashed and forced into this. This is obviously a hard situation because on one hand, it's an open and shut case with Carla's testimony.
Yeah.
I mean, the family gets more answers, police will get more details. But on the other hand, police really have no reason to question pretty, innocent, normal Carla. I mean, Carla's believable in her act. And who wants to believe that Carla was actually a willing participant? Who wants to believe that two people had found each other and married and were this bad together?
Yeah.
This new portrayal of Carla as a victim in this was really hurtful and gaslighty to victims who had lived through Carla and Paul's abuse. Remember, they had victims that they didn't kill.
Uh-huh.
And this was super hurtful because they were like, well, Carla was there. She was participating. But now I'm confused because Carla's come forward and said, I'm a victim in this too. Like, I didn't want to be there. And so they're like, is my reality not what actually happened? On February 17th, 1993, police arrest Paul Bernardo. They search the couple's home for 71 days, and they cannot find the videotapes that Carla had told them about. The videotapes of every single murder
are gone
and every single attack. Carla's proposed word about what happened is all they have. It's really all they have. At Paul and Carla's house, though, they did find blood spots on the walls and pre-made test tubes with drugs just in case they brought a girl home. That was how often they were doing this. Like, they had these packaged and ready to go.
That's so crazy.
They also did find two videotapes that had like TV shows taped over them. But then at the end of it, they had two sexual encounters with two different women.
Okay.
And one of the encounters, the woman looks awake and like a willing participant. So that's fine and crossed off. In the other one, though, the woman looks like she's been drugged. She's not conscious. And both Carla and Paul are participating in sexually assaulting her together. Like, Paul's not sitting there telling Carla what to do.
Uh-huh.
She's doing it on her own. And this is hard because police have just said, oh, she's the victim. We're going to make a plea deal with her and she's going to get off and we're going to get Paul for this. But the plea deal still goes through. And it's made in secret because they didn't have direct evidence leading to Paul to the murders. The only word they had on that was Carla. And everyone in the public thinks Carla is a victim. And they're confused why she would even need to make a plea deal. They're like, wait, she's a victim here. Why does she even need to plead? So June 28th, 1993, Carla goes to court. She is portrayed in court as an abused wife, and she gets manslaughter charges and receives like a 2 12-year sentences to be served concurrently. So that's just 12 years. It's described as the deal of the century, since at that time, police had seen the video of Carla actively participating with Paul, and she still gets manslaughter charges. Carla files for divorce from prison, and the public still knows nothing about the case. They know they've caught the Scarborough rapist, who's the same person who's killed those two girls. They know that they've caught Paul. On May 18th, 1995, Paul Bernardo pleads not guilty to the deaths of Leslie and Kristen, and his trial begins. And at trial, it comes out that after Carla was sentenced, police recovered the missing tapes from Carla and Paul's home. So it was actually the defense. Paul had sent them and said, go get these tapes. Police searched our house and didn't find them. They were hidden in the garage in the ceiling. So the defense went and got them, made copies, prepared everything, took it in, and then handed it over to
police. Is it double jeopardy at this point?
No, no.
Because she's already been sentenced?
For Carla?
For Carla.
No, they could still take away her plea deal.
Okay.
They could still do it, but that's a rocky road. Like, that's a very iffy thing to do, because also then police have to admit they were wrong.
Got it.
Which we know they don't want to do. These tapes come forward and they're admitted into court. And only the jury watches the tapes. The rest of the court only hears audio. That's how gruesome these tapes were. I mean, they are recording assaults, murders, and it's two people.
That would be hard as a jury.
Getting off on it and speaking really crudely and saying really awful things in the tapes. So imagine the family members of Kristen and Leslie having to listen to their girl go through this torture for 2 days. Like, it's completely awful. But to everyone's surprise, the tapes did not show a battered and forced Carla being told what to do.
Yeah.
They show a willing participant in these crimes. So Carla had misled them. In the video, she is fully and willingly participating in the attacks. And had this come out earlier, her infamous plea deal might have gone differently. Paul insists that Carla was the killer, that he had attacked several women and never killed until Carla was in the picture, because she was the one who killed the girls. Now, I do have to say, the actual like murders are not on tape, just the assaults and attacks. September 1st, 1995, Paul Bernardo is found guilty, despite him saying, listen, I didn't do this. Carla killed them because she was jealous of them. I wanted to keep them alive. He is sentenced to basically life in prison with the possibility of parole after 25 years, which will most likely never happen. This is like the maximum sentence you can get in Canada. Behind bars, he admits to Tammy's death. And he also admits to the 14 rapes in the Scarborough area.
Wow.
But he says, but I did not kill Kristen and Leslie. Carla's plea deal is now known as the deal with the devil, one of the worst plea deals in history.
So is she out now then? Because it's been 12 years since 1995.
July 4th, 2005, 35-year-old Carla is released from prison after serving her full sentence.
And she's still released.
She's still released. Okay. Carla is married. She's a mother. And at one point she moved out of the country. But in 2014, she moved back to Canada, became a soccer mom, like PTA, everything. And there's a lot of people in her neighborhood who don't like her. But she's like, hey, back off. Like, I went to prison, I changed, and I'm out. And they're like, yeah, but you got a plea deal when you lied. Like, your deal was made off of a lie. You didn't tell the truth. You said you were battered, and the videos obviously show you're not. So everyone's frustrated that she's even out, because they think that her deal should have been overturned, but it wasn't. This case led to a program to help improve communication between departments, because obviously if they had made these connections earlier, some of these girls might not have been attacked, might still be alive. And that is the case of Carla and Paul, which is also known as the Barbie and Ken case.
Oh my gosh, that was a whirlwind.
It is a whirlwind.
That was horrible.
Because there's just so horrible. Much to it.
We haven't, I feel like, covered many serial killers.
No.
I mean, they killed multiple people.
Together.
Sexually assaulted multiple people.
Well, and it's like he was doing this horrible. Before he met her. He was attacking women. But then he met her, and she somehow they went on to escalate together to murder. Like, what are the chances? And then there's the whole, what you brought up earlier, would she have done this without him? Would he have ever murdered anyone without her? Would she have ever murdered anyone without him? Or did these two just happen to find each other and bring out the evil in each other?
Yeah.
It's a weird case. It's a really like psychological case because what are the chances that this happens?
So weird.
And then also the fact that this is called the Barbie and Ken case because they were the perfect looking, clean cut couple. Like they just looked like every Barbie and Ken doll out there, and they're murderers. Like it's such a crazy case, and that's why it's so infamous.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys, thank you for sticking through that with us. We will see you guys next week with another episode. I love it.
And I hate it.
Goodbye.